Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the co-founder of Mac Observer, Dave Hamilton. Dave, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me, John.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me.
It's nice to be invited on after 81 episodes.
Saving the best for midterm.
For 82. That's right.
Yeah. So you are the, of course, as everyone knows, the co-founder of the Mac Observer, the publisher, the president, and the co-host of the legendary Mac Geek App podcast. But that's the current stuff. I want to jump on the Wayback Machine and ask you about your earliest days. I'm curious. I'm sure the listeners are curious to hear about what you were thinking when you were growing up. How nerdy were you as a youth? Let's start with, you know, like maybe high school. What were your dreams and visions about that time?
It's interesting. I was having this conversation with my daughter recently as she's looking to go to college and, you know, plan schools and all that. In high school, I was very much a nerd. And I was into computers. It probably started in middle school for me. But then when I was in high school, we got an Apple IIc. I was already an Apple II geek. And so having that IIc at home was truly a dream come true. Being able to just do whatever I wanted and have my own computer. I mean, it was the family's computer, but it was mostly mine. And able to just dig in and load all the software that I had that I'd collected over the years and just play with it and learn and all of that stuff that that you get to do. And one of the things that happened and was far more common back then, but certainly still happens today, is I would get myself into a pickle with my computer where it like didn't work or I needed to solve some problem. And, you know, we weren't poor, but we weren't loaded. And so we certainly couldn't hire someone to fix it. So I had to learn how to fix it.
What kind of pickle are you talking about? Are you talking about hardware pickles or basic apps that wouldn't run or what?
All kinds of stuff. Like, you know, making it work just right or installing the no slot clock inside the Apple IIc. Or when I got my first modem, those serial ports on that Apple IIc were wonky, man. Like really, really weird.
Really?
And you couldn't, it was a 9-pin DIN port. And even though it had all the pins that you needed for to connect like a modem to it, right? This was back in the BBS days, pre-public internet access or anything like that. It couldn't do hardware handshaking or anything like that out of the gate.
And so I had an Apple II with a Hayes 300 baud modem and it worked fine.
Well, that's because you put a serial card in there, or you put an internal Hayes 300 baud modem.
I think it was an external little black box, but okay. I think it connected to a serial card.
Yeah, so those serial cards had RS-232 ports, a 25-pin connector on it. You could get everything very, very easily. Mine only had 9, and they weren't wired right. Not right for a modem. It was too smart. It would try to, like, auto-correct it, whatever. So I had to build my own serial cable to get it to do hardware handshaking and flow control and all of that the right way so that I could then set up a bulletin board. And a bulletin board was a place where one person at a time could come and check their email. And
so you weren't logging on to bulletin boards. You were setting up your own?
I was doing both. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so all of that experience combined, and I was doing some programming too, not just on the bulletin board. I ran that on a thing called GBBS that was written originally by Greg Schaefer for the Apple II. But I was doing, you know, some basic programming in BASIC. I also had Pascal eventually on there. But all of that experience combined made me decide at some point to say to myself, what I really want to do for a living, what I want to be, is a computer consultant. Now, you know, this was like...
That's a pretty early decision for such a career. It's interesting.
And it just seemed so obvious to me because I thought, well, I learned how to do all this stuff. But, you know, friends would come over, especially friends of my parents would say, oh, it'd be half joking. They'd say, I want to have you over to my house to help me, you know, set up a computer or whatever. And I thought, yeah, I could be a computer consultant, right? I don't even know that existed back then, but that's what I knew I wanted to do. And And then I had, I went off to college at the University of Connecticut, and I actually never finished. I wound up, I made some bad decisions in I didn't really have a choice as to what school I could go to. I got into a lot of different places, but financially, University of Connecticut was what we could afford. I lived in Connecticut, so I got the in-state discount and all that good stuff. It was a big school. I probably would have liked a smaller school better, but again, didn't have that choice. And I made a critical error. I'm also a drummer. I decided when I went to school for computer engineering that I didn't want anything distracting me, so I didn't join the marching band or any of those bands. And because of that, I had no framework to any social structures. So I really just didn't school just didn't resonate with me. I didn't ever really sync up. So after a couple of years, I found that I wasn't really happy, and also was making more money in the summers doing things like computer consulting. But I always had other businesses. I actually mowed lawns for a couple of summers and then did some temp work that got me involved in some larger companies that really helped
me.
But
when did you fall into the music? Because you're an accomplished musician now. When did that start?
I started playing the drums at 14, and really haven't ever stopped. So,
did you ever think that maybe, despite the fact that you wanted to be a computer consultant, did you ever think that maybe there was a career for you in music?
Yeah, I actually played music full-time for a while and spent about 3 months on the road touring with a band as the drummer, a band called Hypnotic Clambake. That was in the mid-90s.
So, Johnny Evans did that.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no kidding.
That's how he got started.
Yeah. Yeah. So music, I've always said everything good that has happened to me in my life, I can trace back to music. And that includes what we're doing right here, the Mac Observer, because were it not for our shared interest in music and love of music, I don't know that Brian Chaffin and I would ever have bonded as friends. And then that led to us starting the Mac Observer together.
I want to ask you about that in a minute, but I want to back up a second.
Sure.
So you're at the University of Connecticut, and what are you thinking about what's going to happen next in your life? Is that when you started becoming a Microsoft consultant, or was that later?
No. So while I was at UConn, I wasn't really thinking about what was going to happen next, other than, you know, how I was going to make money over the summers and things like that. And that did eventually lead to me just getting work, creating work, and leaving school, because I found in the summers I was making more than friends were making an entire
year. So were you working as an independent contractor? You never went to work for a regular company, right?
No, I started as an independent contractor at a couple of different companies, Deloitte & Touche, General Electric, and then Citibank. And I wound up being full-time at Citibank for, let's call it 3 years. It's sort of chopped up in a different...
That's something I never knew.
Yeah, I was a corporate guy. So, and in fact,
Did you have to wear a suit to work?
I had to wear a tie. But it was fine. Everybody else did too. I mean, it was fine. And that was a fun time, because I was like leaps and bounds ahead technology wise than anyone else. So I really kind of helped lead the department in getting on the internet, and it was just all fun stuff for me. So I got to play. I worked in the division of Citibank that was called at the time the Home Access Division. And so we created a product called Direct Access, which was a dial-up banking product. This was a precursor to what you get at Citibank.com right now.
Mm-hmm.
For people that didn't have computers or weren't comfortable accessing their bank accounts via computers, we partnered with Philips Electronics and created what we called a screen phone, which was an IBM PC XT baked inside of a telephone with a little screen, and it had a pull-out keyboard, and you'd put, and this was, you know, early 90s, you would put a smart card in the side of it. I swear it was the first use of smart cards in the United States. You'd put a smart card in the side that authenticated you, and then you'd type your...
warm fuzzies for the customer.
Yeah, it was all about warm fuzzies, exactly. But really all it was just a terminal session. You just dialed up and connected, and you entered your PIC, your personal information code, not your PIN, because Citibank doesn't call them PINs, they call them PICs. And you type that in, and then you could transfer money around or pay bills or do all the things that we take for granted being able to do. So I got to do a lot of cool stuff at Citibank. But I also learned that I am patently unemployable. They loved me there, but I didn't like how slow things went. Like, for example, we did this, and then personal finance software packages started coming out. You know, Quicken was the big one, as they still are now, although we could have that argument. We won't. but the people at Citibank one day came to me, my bosses and their bosses said, oh, we've partnered with a company called MYOB, and we're going to integrate our online banking into that. And I said, well, okay, that's great, but that's such a small little thing. Why aren't we talking to Intuit? Well, you know, it just doesn't work like that, Dave, they said. And I'm like, well, it could. Can we just call the people at Intuit and see about, well, we have partnerships and this, that, and the other thing. That's stupid.
This is where you figured out in your life that you were the mover and shaker and you wanted to make things happen yourself right now.
Right now. Yeah, it was. I'm an impatient person. Yes, that's exactly right. And I mean, like 18 months after I left, they partnered with Intuit and were in Quicken, and they called me up. They said, just so you know, we now realize you were totally right about that. I know. Like this, it's like, it was, I don't know why we waited. Like, well, you understand that the bank. I'm like, yeah, I do.
So is this where you broke out on your own and started doing Microsoft consulting?
Yeah, it sort of is. So when I left Citibank, I left slowly. I actually scaled myself down from a five-day-a-week employee to a three-day-a-week consultant, and I negotiated with them to basically pay me the same thing, which was awesome. And I had some free time. It meant I had more days off than on. And so I started building a little bit of a consulting business. And this was when I was living in Connecticut, but basically a suburb of Manhattan. It was that New York area where I grew up and where I worked for the bank. And then in 95, my now wife and I decided to move in together. But it would have been too easy to just move in together in the town that we currently lived in. So we moved halfway across the country to Austin, Texas. And we moved in together there.
No, wait. Slow down here. What was the thinking between moving from Connecticut to Austin? What drove you there?
I don't know if you know this story, but it's a great little story. So I knew I had taken a trip with some friends to actually out to Colorado, and we rented a car in, well, Denver, but they lived in Boulder. And then we drove all the way down to the Grand Canyon and back. And I remember distinctly one night, it was about 10 p.m. in Flagstaff, Arizona. We stopped at a 7-Eleven, some sort of convenience store. I think it was a 7-Eleven, but maybe it was some other convenience store. We had to get gas. And I walked in there, and there were several things that caught my attention. The first was that you could buy liquor, guns, and ammunition all at the same place at 10 p.m. That was different for, you know, you couldn't do that in Connecticut. But the other thing I noticed was that everybody there looked me in the eye and said hello. And I thought, things really are different.
People, you know, notice that about the West.
Yeah, yeah, when you live, like when you grow up like I did in close proximity to Manhattan, space is at a premium. Everybody's packed in. And so you create your own space by staring at your shoes when you're amongst the populace.
Mm-hmm.
That's not so much the case everywhere. And I decided I wanted to experience living in a different place. So I posted a message on Usenet to about 15 different news groups describing where Lisa and I wanted to live. I gave no indication as to where we had come from or where we had visited or anything like that. And I said, I'm into computers and music. My wife is into horses. Let's, you know, tell me. And I got about 100 responses. And in sheer, and this was, again, 93, 94, sheer number alone, Austin, Texas, and the San Francisco Bay Area came to the top of the list. So we planned a vacation, 1 week in San Francisco, 1 week in Austin, made a decision, and moved to Austin.
It is a nice town.
I loved it there. We both loved it there. Yeah, and if it weren't for having kids and wanting them to grow up near their grandparents and extended families, we might still be there. So,
pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's time to take a break.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about the founding of the Mac Observer, meeting Brian, and some technical stuff. So, folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with the Mac Observer's Dave Hamilton. So, part two, we're getting to the cool stuff now. And you're in Austin, Texas. And I'm betting that that's where you met Brian Chaffin.
It is. My desire to be a computer consultant led me to meet a gentleman named Lee Robin, who had started a company in San Antonio called Computer Nerds. And he actually sold the one in San Antonio, save a small commission for himself, and moved to Austin to start the next one. He had dreams of global or certainly nationwide franchising, which he at some level actually eventually realized. And so I met him shortly after he started the Austin office and partnered with him on that Austin office. And Computer Nerds was a company sort of like a pre-Geek Squad type of thing, where we had, at the peak of it, we had about 30 nerds, as we called them, us, out in the field helping
Hence
people.
Dave the Nerd.
That's where Dave the Nerd came from. That's exactly right. My clients called me, one of my clients, Mark Majors at Majors Jewelers, called me Dave the Nerd one day when I walked in, and it stuck. So, yeah. So we did that, and I loved that, because it was like, oh, this is great. I'm a computer consultant. We're doing it, you know, on a larger scale and all of that great stuff. And we acquired a company called Web Servers, www.ebservers, that was making websites for people. And we thought that would be a good sister business or place way for us to expand. And Brian Chaffin had started and was running Web Servers. So we brought him and his small team in-house. And so Brian was in the office. He was a Mac guy. I was obviously, well, maybe not obviously, I was a Mac guy, but I also worked on PCs. I would say that 90% of the work, the field work that I did, was on PCs.
That's because PCs required so much nursemaiding, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. I found that 90% of the work that I did on PCs was restoring previous functionality, fixing something that had been broken or had broken on its own, whereas 90% of the work that I did on people's Macs was expanding the functionality, adding printers, whatever it was. And I actually enjoyed the fixing more than I enjoyed the enhancing, simply because, if you remember, I'm impatient, and when I'm fixing a problem, I can work at my speed. When I'm adding functionality and training users, I have to work at their speed.
Because they have to accommodate to the new environment.
Of course. Right.
Right.
So,
But the fixers want it done now.
They want it done right away.
Yeah.
So my impatience served that very, very well for me. And so
fascinating.
Yeah. Plus, we had just a lot more work on PCs. You know, Packard Bell was out in the market at that point, and so they were probably responsible literally for 50% of our business. Those things were so unreliable. It was great. And Windows was awful back then. And
oh, yeah.
So in 98, when Lisa and I built our first house, or not built, bought our first house, I remember walking in and saying, all right, well, this is the house that Microsoft bought for us. But, you know, there you go.
Okay.
So yeah, that's how Brian and I met. And then he was writing for a website called Webintosh. And he would get, you know, review units and cool things. So he would always be excited to show me the latest stuff that he got or whatever was going on. And Webintosh was run by a guy named Dan Hughes. And at some point, it was probably a year and a half or so later, he came to me and said, look, Dan wants to sell Webintosh. Would you be interested in buying it? And it was a pretty inexpensive acquisition. So I thought, sure, why not? I had actually just sold my partner, Lee, and I decided we were better friends than business partners. So I had sold my interest in Computer Nerds. I still worked there as a nerd because I had tons of clients and all of that, and that was fine. But again, I went down to a 3-day-a-week work schedule. So it was that same more off than on thing that I had back in Connecticut. And that meant it was time to do something new. Brian came to me with this at exactly the right time, serendipity. I invested a little bit of money. It wasn't very much. And we were going to just acquire web servers. Webintosh. And run that. And through a process that I now know is called due diligence, we realized that Dan didn't own the domain Webintosh. It had been registered by his friend Bob that had a credit card when Dan needed to register the domain. So we called Bob, and Bob said, no, I won't transfer the domain to you. So the price went down because we weren't, it was like, what are we acquiring here? But Bob said, you can use the domain as long as you want. I said, okay, well, that's good. Because we need to get the traffic from there over to whatever domain we're actually going to use. And on a drive back from San Antonio to Austin, I thought of about 4 names, and Mac Observer was one of them. And when I got back, I walked into Brian's office at our Computer Nerds office and said, check these, and we found Mac Observer was available. That was the one we liked the best.
That was in the day when Apple was enthusiastic rather than protective, I take it.
Yeah, Apple, this was in late 1998. So, you know, beleaguered was a word thrown around a lot when it came to Apple.
Yeah. So you were grandfathered in, blessed with the name Mac Observer, and it's kept that way.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So, and then Bob turned out to be a little bit more of a jerk than we thought. But the good news was, I understood he wouldn't transfer to our new domain name servers, the Webintosh thing, but he also wasn't paying very much attention to what was going on. So I just submitted a change request for Webintosh to point to our new DNS servers that would then let us redirect it to Mac Observer. And I knew what the confirmation, this is not one of my proudest moments, but actually I guess it sort of is. It's just, you know, one of those don't get caught moments. So I knew the way changes to your domain were approved was via an email. They would send you an email and you would just reply to it. But I knew the format of those emails. So I replied as though it might have come from Bob. And so the change to the DNS was approved. And Bob didn't do anything with the domain for the next 3 years. It expired, and now some harvester owns it. So
Was your earliest vision for the Mac Observer, and how is it perhaps different than it evolved later?
Yeah, so I was never interested in... I was never interested in being in the publishing business. Now, you know, I did have a bulletin board, as I said, when I was young. So it could be argued that I had done some of this before. But really, it was just a new business, something to do. It was Brian's job to run all the content. It was my job to run the infrastructure of the business. So I was more interested in the accounting, the servers, all of that stuff. This wasn't a day where you could call up DreamHost and just get an account where you could host your website. WordPress literally didn't exist. There were no content management systems. There was. It was one. It was called Vignette, and it cost $100,000. And I told them they were crazy when they told me that price. So it was up to me to build the servers and find a place to host them, to co-locate them. And then about a year after that, I wrote from hand our first content management system in LAMP, what we call now LAMP. It was, you know, Apache, MySQL, and PHP on Linux. And so that was
the early Artsis that I knew.
Right, we called it Artsis. That's correct. Yeah, and I think by the time you saw it, we could actually put content in it. Brian was just publishing with GoLive. And it was fraught with opportunities for human error that we took advantage of multiple times a day. So the first thing that I did was built an automated system for publishing the homepage. So the only thing you would put in was teaser and then link to the article. And that would be auto-generated both on the homepage and at the end of each article. And the content was still uploaded manually via FTP, but we were only uploading one file instead of 16 or something. And then Artsis would take care of the rest. And eventually we enhanced it to where we were actually putting the content in. And then we moved to Expression Engine, which at the time was absolutely sounded like a great decision and turned out to be a really bad one. And then last year, we moved to WordPress.
My, how things have changed.
Yeah, I still, there's part of me, and Adam Christensen and I talk about this a lot. There would still be a lot of benefit if we were still just running our own content management system, but that's a discussion for another day. WordPress has been pretty good for us.
Yeah, I like WordPress. It's worked out pretty well. It's easy to learn.
Yeah, and it allows a lot of flexibility for us with built-in functionality that we don't have to cook up ourselves. So perhaps we're better off now with WordPress than we were with our own CMS. But anyway, so that's where Mac Observer started anyway. But that was just, you know, it was just articles. We had a lot of columnists. That was a big cornerstone of what paid columnists. Oh yeah, we paid everybody from day one. Absolutely, always have. And we were writing a lot of, it was news and columns was really what it was. Podcasts weren't even a thing back then.
So. When did Bob join? Bob Levitis.
Yeah, so Bob, I met because of music.
He was in Austin, right?
Well, he was. Okay, so, right. I met Bob at Power Computing before Mac Observer ever existed, before Brian and I...
He told us the story of Power Computing on Background Mode. That was great.
Yeah, I was introduced to him at Power Computing, but he was a rock star at that point. Like, it was him and Ted Landau, Kurt Christensen. Bob wrote for everybody. Ted Landau had Mac Fix It. Kurt Christensen had... Version Tracker, and Rick Ford had Macintouch, right? And so those were the sites I read every day, and so I knew of Bob and all of that, but he was, you know, it was like, oh, wow, that's cool. It's great to meet you. We didn't have a business for him to work at, let alone a position to offer him or anything. So I met Bob because of the Macworld All-Star Band, which might be getting ahead of us, but might not, but that was a rock band that was formed to play at parties at Macworld Expo, so that there would be a band of people that meant something to the community instead of just some local cover band. And that worked out well, and Bob joined that band, and so he was one of the founding members of it, I guess, just like me. And that's how we met, and that's how the friendship started. And then Brian eventually joined that band. He talked his way into it, as Brian can do. And that's how he met Bob, and then eventually we started earning a little bit of money, and we could hire some celebrities, and so Bob was one of them.
Cool,
that's how that kind of worked. Yeah.
Hey, I want to switch gears here for a second.
Okay.
Move ahead.
Yeah, sure.
So Mac Observer is rolling along, and then there comes a time when Mac Geek Gab, the legendary podcast of yours and John Brown's, is formed. Tell me about the formation of that.
Yep. So I lived in Austin, but we moved back to the Connecticut area after our kids were born. After our daughter was born, our son was born in Connecticut. We moved back to be near family. And then after about four and a half years of that, we remembered why we left Connecticut. We didn't like being that close to New York. So we started looking elsewhere, but we wanted to be a drive away. And we bought the house that we're in now in New Hampshire. And we had some construction to do, so I was spending a lot of time in the car going back and forth between Connecticut and New Hampshire at least once a week, checking on the progress of the construction that we're doing here at the house. And I listened to podcasts. This was right about the time podcasts were starting. You know, we bought this
house. What year was this?
We moved into this house in 2005. And I was listening to a lot of podcasts. And a guy named Mike Dunn, who is he's a M&A guy. He's worked for all kinds of different companies. I think he was with Hearst Publishing at the time. He said, I had dinner with him one night. And he's like, you should start a podcast. I thought, oh, yeah, I should start a podcast. Right. And then I remembered that John Braun and I grew up together. We ran bulletin boards together in Connecticut. And, of course, when we moved back to Connecticut, John and I started seeing each other regularly again. You know, we'd come over for dinner and hang out with the family or whatever. And I thought, you know, when we moved to Texas, I sort of lost touch with John. I mean, we'd catch up once every 6 weeks, maybe once every 3 months, that kind of thing. But it wasn't regular. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we did a podcast together? And then that way, it would force us to have a conversation each week, and we could just record whatever we talked about. And that was the original idea for Mac Geek Gab. Was, okay, yep, I want to do this thing at TMO, and I want to keep in touch with John. And so it was, Mac Geek Gab was born. The first two shows, I think we talked about Tiger. Is that right? Mac OS X Tiger on the first show. And then we had a topic for the second one. And then I didn't know the topic for the third one. And I thought, well, why don't we pretend that we have a lot of listener mail? I had previously, years before, written a column here at Mac Observer called Ask Dave. And there would still be questions coming into that. It was basically just Q&A. I'm the consulting guy. I know how to answer people's questions. I like doing that. And I still had some questions flowing in, even though it was years later. So I took some of those questions and queued them up and said that listeners had written in. And we answered their questions. And then the mailbag started to fill up. So we answered the questions for the next week. And for the next 12
questions,
years.
Questions. We have questions.
Yeah. So it became Car Talk for Apple geeks. For kids, if you don't understand the reference, ask your parents. But yeah. Yeah. So that's really how that started. It
was Mac Talk coming to you from Harvard Square.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Yep.
So tell me a little bit about the technology of podcasts in 2005. What kind of tools and primitive stone knives and axes were you using for podcasts then?
You know, not a whole lot different than what I'm using today. I knew when we started Mac Geek Gab that I didn't want to have a ton of post-production to do because I knew how busy I was. I knew that if it was going to take me 2 hours or 3 hours to do editing and post-production, that would get delayed and delayed, and then we wouldn't be releasing on a regular schedule. And I just innately figured that we wanted to release consistently because that's how things go. That's how people's lives are, even though as podcasters you can record whenever you want. I knew I wanted to release on a schedule. So I built a setup that would let me publish within 15 minutes of stopping the recording. And to do that, I record live. Unfortunately, there are no tools available for all-in-one podcast recording, especially when you get Skype involved. So the tools that I used back then are largely the same I use today. I have an outboard mixer. This mixer might be like 10 years old. I mean, it really is. That I've got a couple of outboard compressor limiters with noise gates in them to make the sound nice, like when you get real up on the mic.
Like and this. Yes. Right,
exactly. And then I used Audio Hijack Pro is what it was called back then to sort of capture the audio and route it. I had a lot of this gear, and more importantly, I had the knowledge of routing audio from all of my music stuff. I became the de facto sound person years ago. Being a drummer, all the gear was always at my house because nobody wanted to move drums for rehearsal. So I always had it and sort of learned about audio gear that way.
This reminds me of James Burke and Connections. All this technology, the audio, the consultancy work, the desire to fix things, just brought you to this fulfillment of the... Yeah. Of the vision and the ability to do things and create web servers and build podcasts. It all kind of came together.
Yeah, that's it. It's just, you know, I cobbled it together and I basically do this exact same thing today. I'm really excited. Adam Curry, who was one of the people that started podcasting, is building he's got a Kickstarter that he's about to launch, building a box, an external box for podcasters to do exactly what I do here. Which is also happens to be exactly what he does in his studio, but all in one box that makes it portable, but also simple for someone to set up and not have to go get all this outboard gear and still get a good sound. I knew that I wanted to hear what in audio is called the third head, the playback head, in my ears. I want to hear the recorded sound in my ears so I know what all the processing and effects has done to my audio so that I can record one track, and it's just like live radio DJs do. You hear it, you know everything's good, you can adjust the levels on the fly, that kind of thing. So he's got a box coming. I'll write more about that on TMO.
Cool. And I'm using that technology right here that you developed and passed on to Jeff Gammon and me.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, you're doing it mostly in software. And obviously it works, but there's some limitations to that that hopefully we can solve for you if Mr. Curry is successful.
Cool. We're just about out of time. Boy, we had just blown through this. I wanted to ask you about some Apple events and technologies, but I think we're going to have to save that for another show.
Well, that sounds fine by me, man. Anytime. This is a pleasure.
Hey, it's been an interesting story. I never realized the full breadth of your technical background and how things all came together in the fashion that they did. This has been a very interesting story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Oh, thanks. It's been an interesting one to live. I can't wait to see what the next 20 years brings me.
One final thought. Speaking of the next 20 years, how do you feel about the future, maybe the next 10 years of Mac Observer, online magazines, podcasting? Do you have any thoughts about... Because things change so fast. Do you see any trends or any visions for... Because nothing stays the same forever. How do you think this is going to go in terms of, you know, online websites and their associated podcasts and things that we do today and the evolution of those things?
Yeah, you know, so there's a couple of facets to that, and I'll try and address them succinctly. Advertising or revenue is going to be an interesting one. Simultaneously, we have this weird scenario on the web in terms of revenue where everything is direct response driven, meaning you hear ads on podcasts where you have a coupon code so that you can track what people bought. And on the web, there's a big focus on clicks and all of that. And that's fine, but it's incorrect. There is the web and especially podcasts are much more geared, much better geared towards branding advertisements, right? Where you're just getting into the mindset and mind share of the audience. And the good news is so many dollars are going to need to move from TV and radio to somewhere. And so I think we'll see a change there. We're in a weird little, I don't want to call it a lull, but sort of a plateau right now as that is coming together. So I think in 5 years, that shakeout will have happened and we'll have a whole lot more interest there. In the meantime, though, I think direct support from listeners and direct support from audiences, value for value support, as I like to call it, is going to be part of it for a small percentage of the people that are publishing. And I think that small percentage is going to be a large percentage of those that succeed. Now, what I haven't mentioned is how AR and VR are going to change how we experience our news and content consumption dramatically.
Mm.
So I think everything I said might be totally valid, but not in the way that we think of it today. Because I think 5 to 10 years from now, AR and VR own how we consume information.
I better comb my hair.
There you go. Or maybe you don't have to. Maybe your avatar just is always well coiffed, my friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we really have to go now. Okay. I want to thank you again for being on the show. It's been a great story. Again, thank you for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Yeah, the best way to find me is at Dave Hamilton on Twitter. That's an easy one. Or, you know, I'm always around at MacObserver.com and MacGeekGab.com.
All right, great. Well, listeners, I'm glad you came by, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for being a listener. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.